Hi, it's Thursday. Get around to the bio. Truth is, it's going to be a biggie because someone who wants to be anonymous, but who's a good friend of our podcast, asked me to do somebody I wasn't really going to do so much, but okay, I will. And that's Naftali Katz. I'm telling you, Cohen Katz, who's a big rabbi of the early modern period that most of you never heard of. So it's not exactly like the Megala Mukas, which is what I did last time, that some people have heard of it. Now, Naftali Katz is a Smichas Chachamim. I doubt if most people are familiar with this. And he has like a complicated biography. And I was a little bit hesitant to do it. But since I was asked, and like I said before, it's a good sponsor, a friend of ours. So I'm going to do it. So that's what I'm doing today, Naftali HaKohen. Katz is like my name, Cohen Tzedek, you know, so when you see them, someone named, a rabbi named Katz, in the old days, almost always it's somebody Cohen said it's a Cohen, right? It doesn't have to be, there are Katz that are not Kohanim. Usually I think those are abbreviations from Katz and Ellenbogen, which is the name of a town in Germany, but, you know, that's a different thing. Okay, so as I've done 100 times, when you deal with East European rabbis in the 15th, 16th, 1700s, and he lived, our hero today lived from 1648 to 1718 or 1719. So what does that mean? About 70 years old, yeah. Actually, 70, 71. So that's a fairly long life, especially in those days. So he was a big rabbi in Poland and elsewhere. Well, so what? There are a dime a dozen. Now, as you talk about Gedolim of a certain type, there's a zillion of them. So the question becomes, what makes this one special, the subject of a biography? You're looking for aspects that are distinctive or unique. At least that's what strikes to me. So that it certainly is the case by our hero today, Rabbi Naftali Katz, even though I'll say it again, I'm sure the vast majority of you never heard of the one I'm talking about. So let's talk about first the commonalities. This is a big rabbi in Eastern Europe. If it's the 17th century, which it is, then it means like this. He's born in the right family. He grew up to be Eloi. He married the right girl. He was related to the right people. He had all the yichas. He knew how to maneuver in communal politics, at least to some extent. Like all the famous rabbis of the past, he had machlokes and arguments with the Balabatim in different places. That goes along with the territory. And he wrote some svarim, you know. So I don't know if his are actually well known. I mean, they are by those that know. You know how that works. And I've always sort of not been into him, but nevertheless, a very remarkable character, you'll see in a second. And, you know, and like I said before, and he had the right children, and so on and so forth. So this is somebody who operated in the early modern era in Ashkenazic Europe. And Ashkenazic Europe means at that time, Eastern Europe plus Germany. It's all one big blob. I understand in Poland, they speak Polish and German. I get that. But as far as the Jewish situation is concerned, is all one big blob, which is why he moves from Germany to Poland and back and forth, because all the Jews talk Yiddish. In Echanami, in Germany, they talk a German type Yiddish, and Galicia, a different type of Yiddish, and Lithuania, a different type of Yiddish, but fundamentally it's the same. If you know Yiddish, you can understand somebody else. I can, you know, you know how it works. What I say is the real Yiddish, and your way sounds funny. I mean, but we understand what we're talking about, just like in English. I can listen to somebody from Australia, or England, or this, that, and the other, and the Bahamas even, and, you know, I understand what they're saying, even though we talk different, because fundamentally we're in one language group. So Ashkenazi Jewry was like that, and even in terms of Minhag Ashkenaz and all that sort of thing, I know there are little differences here and there, and there's the narcissism of small differences and so forth, but having said that, it was one big blob, and Jacob Katz has a whole famous article about this, I think, if I remember correctly. I think when he did Tradition and Crisis long ago. Okay, so that's the world, the universe in which our hero operates. Now, what is distinctive? We're talking about somebody, because you'll see, like so many others, he became a big gadol, he was a rabbi here, then for one reason or another he moved there, then for another reason he moved there, and then moved back here and there and the other thing has happened. So if I told you he's born in this town, he was a rabbi here, most of it wouldn't mean anything to you because you have no idea what the geography of Eastern Europe in the 17th, 18th century was Jewish-wise, the vast majority of you. So, but what parts do matter? I'll tell you. First of all, here's someone born in Volhynia, which is eastern Poland. Today it's Ukraine. But it, you know, it's all part of Polish Yiddish-speaking Jewry. And he's a product of a town I'm sure most of you have no idea what I'm talking about. And that is Ostrow. Now, not Ostrow, O-S-T-R-O-W. That's a town in Poland. But rather Ostrog, which sometimes they spell with a G on the end, and sometimes with an H on the end, because in Russian, they don't say H like we do in America. You know, in other words, Harry Hopkins is Gary Hopkins, like that sort of thing. Now, Ostrow was where the Marshal was, for example. So again, I know that I'm saying something that you don't know what I'm talking about, so, you know, live and learn. It was one of the Iker cities of the Jews in Eastern Europe in the early modern period. I would even go so far as to say Ostrow was, I won't necessarily say like a Volozhin, but it certainly was like a Mir or a Telz or a Slobodka type place. In other words, it was the Ir Vein B'Yisrael, and it had very chashuv yeshivas. And from there went rabbis all over the place. Learned there. So our hero is born there, okay? Who's, and you know, and his father was a Talmud Chacham in this, and was a rabbi in this little town and that little town. But Ostrog is a big town. I remember it might have been, well, it wasn't the largest Jewish community, but among the largest, because by the time of Khmelnytsky, it had 7,000 Jews. That's very large for those eras, okay? And so it's on the Bug River, and it's well situated commercially. And so the Jews did a lot of business over there. And it was the castle and the headquarters of one of the great Polish princes and families, the magnates, the Ostrogski family, actually. That's why it's called Ostrog. And in other words, that's where the local Polish prince has his castle and his headquarters and all the rest of it, which is very common in those days. That's what a lot of Jews would form there. First of all, there's a lot of business to be done with the prince and his household. And secondly, it's just more secure. Wherever the nobleman lives, that's where he'll have a lot of soldiers and stuff like that. And the Jews need that because the soldiers protect the Jews simply because the Jews are the bees that produce the honey for the nobleman, so to speak. You know, their economic activity, he gets a big chop off the top. And, you know, that's the way they did business in Poland, which was good for the Jews. And as I've said 100 times, it was a perfect storm, culturally speaking, because, you know, the prince and the Polacks, they don't want to have nothing to do with the Jews other than business, and the Jews feel the same way, and 10 times as much. So it was a happy hunting ground of cultural insularity. So you could have a prosperous Jewish community, quite prosperous, and lives by itself, no ghettos, just lives in a Jewish neighborhood, and there's a big shul there. I think there still is. The Marshal Synagogue is famous. It's been wrecked by World War I and World War II and the communists and all that. And if I remember correctly, you look it up, maybe there's efforts to rebuild it and so forth, you know, for tourism. It was a large synagogue, and there were yeshivas, and it was a place, Ir Shel Chachamim B'Sofrim, it really was. Now, again, I know if I say Ostra, it doesn't mean anything to anybody, unless I say, if I want to use shorthand for Americans, I say, that's where the Marshal was. Oh, okay. Then they say, okay. Because you figured Marshal knew. But the reason is because his mother-in-law and all that was rich, like all these other Jewish successful business people in Ostrow. And, you know, she could afford to bankroll his yeshiva in the time of the Marshal. Then the Marshal died around 1640. Our hero was born 8 years later in 1648. Now, 1648 is the year of the Cossack massacres of Khmelnytsky, Xerath Takhbatat. So, in other words, he was born in a fairly dangerous place. At the beginning of the Ukrainian attacks on the Jews that we called the Xerath Takhbatat. And I remember that the city of Ostrow was wiped out. So I don't know exactly how he survived. It's a fair question. Notice, let me put it this way. Obviously, he wasn't killed. So I'm just conjecturing. I think the whole community was wiped out, I think. So maybe he lived in a nearby place that wasn't hit by the Cossacks, or maybe something else. I just know it's very famous that he was at one point kidnapped by the Tatars. Now, did this happen when he was young? Did this happen when he's old? I don't know the answer to that question, but I'll give the most intelligent guess that I can give. And that is the following. Poland, where he lived, it's all part of the Kingdom of Poland. If you're interested in what I'm talking about, look up a map online. The Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, it was called. The Rzeczpospolita, but you won't know how to spell that. Just look up the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth or the old Kingdom of Poland, which was huge and included the whole Ukraine as well as Poland, Lithuania, and the Belarus, etc., etc. Now, the Poles used to be the bosses, and they lorded it over the Ukrainians and the others who were there until finally the Ukrainians, Cossacks that we call them, rose up against the Polacks. And in 1648-1649, they had a hell of a big war, and they killed a lot of Polish, and they killed a belt of Jews. That's why we called the Czarist Takpatat. And there were two groups that were fighting against the Poles. One was the Cossacks, the other one was the Tatars. Now, the Tatars are Muslim. And I know, just from history, that Austria, where our hero lived, there were a lot of Tatars around there. As a matter of fact, the Jews did a lot of business with them. So that's how it works in good times. Because the Tatars are part of the Turkish Empire. So let's say I'm Jewish and a business person. I can sell junk to the Turkish Empire and import stuff. And that's what they did. If you ever take, I mean, I don't want to bore you too much, but if you ever take the trouble to look up, you know, what they used to do, I mean, the Jews imported this and they exported that. So great, right? That's fine, right? Nothing wrong with that. And here, let me see. 1 second. Just give you a little bit of an idea of what's happening over there. Do they say? Nah. It's, I guess not. But I remember once reading, you know, what the Jews were into. The reason I mention it is, so there was money there, and they were from, and therefore that's one of the reasons he had yeshivas and that sort of thing. And our hero was born into this elite class, literally in the last year of the old Poland, okay? And he's going to live his life post-Takvatat. And they all say that he was taken b'shviba al-yidei ha-kadarim, which means he was kidnapped and held as a slave by the Tatars. So when Khmelnytsky launched the Cossacks against the Poles, the Tatars joined him, and they had two armies. And if you fell in the hands of the Cossacks, they would kill you if you didn't convert. Or if you're a little child like our hero was, they literally tear you apart. I mean, it's not an exaggeration. That's what they found fun. The Cossacks are sick dogs, and they like to, you know, either trample the babies or pull them apart or eat them or stuff like that. Now, I'm really not exaggerating. The Tatars, on the other hand, were businesslike. Notice they didn't have anything particularly against the Jews. They just want to kidnap people and sell them as slaves. So I don't know how he got out of it. It's famous that he was captured, and he writes in his last will and testament that he was rescued, or he escaped somehow or other, or maybe somebody did a pidyon shvuyim on him. We don't know. All I'm saying is that makes him already different than regular Godel. Now, if this happened when he's 3 or 4 or 5, that's one thing. If it happened when he's 15, 16, 17, that's another thing. But it happened somewhere when he was young. And all we know is he escaped and then threw himself into learning after he escaped. Okay? So this is not atypical of people living in his time. It was the wrong time to be born in Poland, in that area. The wars of the Cossacks and all this junk lasted from 1648 to 1672. So by the time the final peace happened, our hero would have been 24, and this happened before that. So it's somewhere along the lines over there. He's a victim of the bad times in Poland. Now, the interesting thing is, even though he lost 2 years of learning, let's say for argument's sake, he was kidnapped at the age of 13 till 15, or 14 till 16, or something like that. So how do you become a Godel? You got to go through Shas once, and then do it again, and then do it again, and do it again. I'm being serious, okay? Now, after you did it the 10th, 15th time, it ain't so hard. So that you need time and the luxury to do it. He lost 2 years in that, but he made up for it, obviously, afterwards, because he became one of the big Gedolim. So here's somebody who knows how to learn up a storm, obviously. And it's clear, once he was rejoined Judaism, that he was a rising star, and he had all this big yichus. I forgot to say, he's like a great-grandson of the Maral, you know, something like that. Great-grandson, I think, of the Maral. And, you know, it's already had all this yichus coming up to here. And the community was destroyed, but then it was, but what did the Jews do after Gzeres Tachbetat? The answer is whoever survived had no choice but to pick up the pieces. It's not like there was a state of Israel. It's not like there were reparations payments by Germany. Nobody gave you nothing. So either you, let's say you had a business and your whole family was killed. And you're the only survivor and your business was burned down to the ground. You have no choice. I'm serious now. But to, and you're bloodied and battered. There were so many Jews were like this, beaten up by the Cossacks and so forth, maimed. You try to get healed, you know, right? Try to recover your health. You start another business as best you can. You hope for luck. You try to get remarried. Try to start another family. And hope for the best. I mean, that is what people did. So he's from that generation that grew up in his lifetime. That's what you're talking about. So in his town in Ostrov, there had been a yeshiva. There had been shuls and all the rest. So it was destroyed by the Cossacks. They were killed out. I should say they were exterminated by the Cossacks. But now the people came and it's still a good spot for business. You know what I'm saying? Because once the wars are over, it still is commercially located in a very favorable location near the Turkish border and on the Bug River and so on and so forth. And so the Jews, Konoga picked up the pieces. I remember that the guy who led the rebuilding of the city was Shmuel Shmelki, right? Shmuel Shmelki Zak. Zak means it comes from Zerikosh, from people who died al-Kesh Hashem. So he must have been a very impressive type dude because he was Talmud Chacham, he came the rabbi there, whatever, you know, maybe he's the only one there. And he funded the revival of the yeshiva there. And our hero married his daughter. That's the point I want to get to. Esther Shendel, who will become famous by the time I'm finished. I don't know if I'll finish this all today. Maybe we'll make two parts. But she'll become famous by being the object of our hero's adoration in a most non-rabbinical way in his famous Last Will and Testament. but anyway, so here we have a young guy, his early 20s, and he's learning away, and the father-in-law is rich, and he's like supporting him. And, you know, he's, let's put it this way, he's got Targdul Mamakam Echad, okay? And how should I put it over here? The father-in-law dies when he's 29. He gets the position. Again, that happened a lot. But there must have been opposition to him. And this is the stuff they hide in the biographies. Because, as I just told you, really, Ostro was like a chashuva town. It's like being the Telzerov or something like that. With Rabbi and Mir. I mean, it's a chashuva position. Especially if you're interested in learning. And what I mean by that is, you can be sure, as the son-in-law of the Rav and the, and, you know, one of the rich guys, I mean, he's not only learning, he gave shiurim. He becomes a Baki in Halacha. He becomes good in Drush. You can see from his writings. He has a very good Hebrew style. And he's into Kabbalah. That's one of the things that sort of set him apart. And he's going to be into Kabbalah, not only in the theoretical level, in the philosophical Kabbalah, which is, you know, not easy. What I mean is a Kisei Arizal, but also in what we call Kabbalah Ma'asit. Excuse me, which is practical Kabbalah, which is one step away from magic. That's what the guy we're going to think of him as a master of black magic, even though, you know, it's not. But you're talking about using Seamus and this and that and the other, and he's going to be, as far as I can see, Mr. Kamiyas, the guy who gives out amulets to protect you against illness and protect you against having fires and protect you against these sorts of things. And there is a whole science to the Kamiyas, the whole science to the Kamiyas, especially in the 17th century. His contemporary in Italy, Moshe Zacuto, wrote a book. I have the book called Sharshi HaShemus, which is all the different possible formulations for Kamiyas. You know, this Shem HaShem, that one, and this is good for, you know, the measles, and that one's good for smallpox, the other one's good for Shaduchim, and so on and so forth. And this was an era when this was very hot in Judaism, the Kamiyas. That's why Abishutz will get in trouble, you know, with this in the 1700s. And think about what I'm about to say. Our hero is a contemporary of Shabtai Tzvi. If he's born in 1648 and the whole Shabtai Tzvi episode exploded in 1666, then our hero was 18 years old when the Shabtai Tzvi business hit Poland. And remember, the big rabbis in Poland, a lot of them believed in him, tentatively or totally. And as a matter of fact, who was the rabbi after him? Maybe at his time also, I don't know how that works out. The Taz. He was an Ostro. And you know, the Taz is famous that he sent his son to talk to Shabtai Tzvi in Turkey and so on and so forth. So this is, must have been a major element in his adolescent education, you might say. The Kabbalah is popping all over the place. Now, after Shabtai Tzvi exploded, so there's different sets of attitudes in reaction. One was stay away from Kabbalah, which I totally get. Okay? In other words, look trouble you can get into. That's one way. Another way is get into Kabbalah and see if you can become another Shabtai Tzvi. A third way is, which often happened, these people got into Kabbalah and then convinced themselves that they're the Mashiach. You think I'm making fun of this, but this is what happened in the late second half of the 17th century, early 18th century, especially in Eastern Europe and in the Turkish Empire. And, you know, you're another Shabtai Tzvi, or you're reincarnation Shabtai Tzvi, who the heck knows? A third way is to learn of Kabbalah very heavily. I won't say Da Masha Toshiv, but something like that, so that you won't be misled by phonies. You get it? But in order to do that, you have to have, like, quote-unquote, a PhD in this stuff. I mean, you have to really master the Kisvei Ari and the obviously the Zohar and the other writings and know what they mean, not to what they say, but what they mean. And obviously, this is not hard. And our hero is going to get into this in a very big way. And that's going to be part of his reputation as a practical Kabbalist. And it, but that shouldn't take away from the Nigla side, as I always try to say. You know, so this guy was a Rosh Hashiva. He gave Shurim. His book, Smichas Chacham, is all full of lumdas. And, you know, the reason he calls Smichas Chacham is, I tell you the truth, I've seen it and I never bought it. I don't know what it is. I never got into it. But he's a classic guy from the time of the Taz and the Shach and all that. And, you know, the Smichas Chacham, he tries to show you lumdas-wise how the different mesectives connect with each other. Get it? Smichas Chachamim, ha, ha, ha. And he's also got on brachas and on Zeroim. And, you know, it's like lumdish stuff, and he is a good writer. I don't know exactly why, but he and I never clicked. Maybe it's my fault, you know, could be. But he and I never clicked. But I know there's a chashuva, a sefer, but it's one of those chashuva sefers that has no traction. What I mean by that is, they're famous rabbis who wrote famous books over the course of time, or strings of books, and they didn't take off. Maybe they should have, maybe they shouldn't have. Raise your hand if you ever heard of the Sefer Smichas Chacham, and raise two hands if you ever looked in it or read it. I don't think many, as opposed, for example, to the Marshal or the Pnei Yeshua or something like that, which are universal. So some books have mazel, some books don't have mazel. Some Sfarim have mazel. You know what they say? I feel a Sefer Torah Shebehekel Tzrichan Mazel. It don't work out like that all the time, right? But that doesn't take away from the quality of it. Now, as I said before, he must have fights with the Valavatim. I myself can just conjecture, since he was the son of the rich guy before him, you know, he made enemies. People didn't like him. I don't know. But all I know is that he moved from Austria to Posen, which is all the way on the other side of Poland, of Eastern Europe. Posen is the part nearest to Germany, which is why later on the Prussians annexed it. And it was a chashuv Jewish town. Always a lot of anti-Semitism there. Oh boy. And what's famous is that he gave the, when he's in the community in Posen. So what I mean to say is like this. He's an Av Beis Din. You know, let's put it this way. He's in charge of the Kashrus, in charge of the Gittin, in charge of the Erev. You know, this is heavy stuff. And giving Shurim, and he's Talmidim, and so on and so forth. But he's also into giving Kamiyas out, and it's supposed to be famous. Yeah, that he gave like a kamiya, not a kamiya, like a little, this is going to sound funny, like a little idol in the form of the head of a deer. Isn't that weird? It's not an idol, of course, it's the head of an animal. And I guess it must have writings on it, Kabbalistic stuff. And let's put it this way, that's a protection against a fire. And I think later on they broke parts of it and different people took pieces of it, as happens with these sorts of things. All I know is it's kind of famous, Rabbi Kiv Eger, who later was imposed on me. He had like a piece of it from his ancestor and so on and so forth. Did it protect against fires? I don't know. All I know is that here we are in the late 1600s, and our hero has already reached, you know, the career goals that you would expect. He became rabbi of a leading, of Beis Din, of a leading community in Poland. He was about 50 at the time, approximately, late 40s or 50. And, you know, let's put it this way. So his career was on a regular path, okay? A regular path. However, he moves from there, and it seems he got in a fight with the Balabatim over there also. And in his will, he says, I forgive everybody for causing me trouble. You know, that's the usual formula that they write. But, and we'll never know, because, you see, I want to tell you something. The rabbinate in Poland especially, or anywhere, in those years was always fraught with a problem. Why? Because in almost every kehillah, every Jewish kehillah had several different mafias, let's call it that. I don't mean in the criminal sense, but, you know, teams. So let's say, for argument's sake, there's Team Schwartz, there's Team Friedman, there's Team Cohn. Just give me an example. And they're always quarreling with each other, because remember, in these communities, there was only like one shul or maybe two. Therefore, who gets to do Shabbos, who gets to Haftar and Shabbos Nachmo? Who gets Shlishi? Who becomes the Gabbai of this? Who is elected in the elections and being charged at a Chevra Kadisha? Little things like this was big fights. And basically, they're competing for influence. This is the sad side of Jewish history. And therefore, anybody's a rabbi, if you get elected, let's put it this way. How did he get elected? There was an election. So it must mean that Team Schwartz and Team Cohn teamed up against Team Friedman, whatever, and they outnumbered him in votes, and they slipped in their guy to be the Rav. Well, that means that Team Friedman was defeated, and therefore it'll always be in their interest to undermine the rabbi. You get what I'm saying? Because he's not our candidate. He was the enemy candidate. Now, I know it sounds silly. This is how life was lived. And Gedol Yisrael suffered a lot from this junk. So, Vayikach Korach, when they say B'nai Korach Lameisu, that's just part of how life was lived. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, even though he got a reputation for being a Kadosh and a Gaon and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, he did the Tikkun Katzos and all the business. I mean, if you're a Mekubal in the Frum sense, not in the Sabbatian sense, you have a lot of Chumras out there. You understand? And if you read his last will and testament, it's Mali Chumras on himself. So, you know, he had this kind of reputation, and he's giving out the Kamiyas and all the rest of it. And I think it was in 1704. So, no, it's when he's in his 50s, he leaves Posen to go to Frankfurt. So he became a Yeki. Frankfurt the Main, Pfaffdam, Frankfurt the Main. But I told you 100 times, there was no Yekis in the 18th century or the 17th century. They were just Ashkenazi Jews. Talk with a German accent. Yiddish with a German accent. That's all it is. A South German accent in this case. So he became Rabbi in Frankfurt, which is why there's a biography of him, so-so, in that famous book, Frankfurter Rabbinen, Rabboni Frankfurt from Mordechai Horowitz. Famous, he goes through all the different rabbis. Now, in Frankfurt, so okay, that means he's one of the Gedolei Ador, because whoever's Rabbi in Frankfurt is, you know, let's put it this way. The community was 3,000 people, which was not only very large, but I would say too large, because, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, the Frankfurt ghetto was by law really restricted, and it was hard to live in those physically restricted quarters, and you know people had to do it, right? The people had to do it, so it wasn't easy, but in those quarters were famous, you know, schools and yeshivas and so on and so forth, you know what I mean, right? And it really was the era of Ein Yisrael. That is true. And that means he was, let's put it this way, he reached the top of the greasy pole. Ordinarily, that's where he would spend the rest of his life. He was in his mid-50s when he came there. He's already someone with a big reputation. And Nigla and Nister, no question about it. I'm sure the fact that he knew the Kamiya's business and the Nister stuff just added to it. And I think this is where he publishes the Smichas Chachamim, His Lamdisha Sefer, which obviously reflect the fact that he gave shiurim in the yeshivas and all that sort of business. And he reached the top of the pole. And as such, he engages, as Gedolim used to do, especially 17th, 18th century, in the controversies of the day. The most famous one that I know about offhand is, what do you call it, the chicken without a heart. Remember that one? You've heard of that before, right? The Chacham Tzvi versus, I think, David Oppenheim. In other words, a girl brought a shayla, I think it was, with a chicken, and it didn't have a heart. And they opened it up and didn't have a heart. So what's that? So you might say like this. For some weird reason, this chicken didn't have a heart. Then it's a trefa. However, on the other hand, logic doesn't seem that a chicken could live without a heart. And so, therefore, you say there's a heart, but, you know, it fell down, or some animal ate it on the way, or the girl who brought it dropped it, or something like that. You understand? So do you presume it's a trefa just on looking at it, or do you use common sense? And the Chacham Tzvi said, use common sense, and therefore had a heart just disappear. So it's basically kosher. And David Oppenheimer and many others, what do you call it? They said, no, it's, you know, it didn't have a heart. And, you know, they had all kind of Aristotelian and other kind of theories. How could something live without a heart? And, you know, the science, you know, what's his name? Professor Maoz Kahana, who I know a little bit, published a whole book on this. I'll bet you this forum chatter must have talked about it. Yeah, here it is. Tarni Golet Bali Lev Dat Umada B'Kesiva Rabbanit B'Meha Shemana Esrei. Isn't that an interesting title? How would they put it in English here? Let me move to the back. You know, you get these Israeli books in the back, usually is English title, without me having to translate it for you. Nope, not here. Okay, Tarni Golet Bali Lev, and the chicken without the heart. And it's a study in religion, and here it is, Heartless Chicken, Religion and Science in Early Modern Rabbinic Culture. It's close enough to the Hebrew translation. And it's hundreds of pages, you know, 300 and some pages, where he goes into science and halacha and all this other business in the beginning of the 18th century. And like I say, it was a big brouhaha. Our hero sided with the Chacham Tzvi. He said, it doesn't make sense that the chicken didn't have a heart, and therefore, you know, it's kosher, and David Oppenheimer is wrong, which was a whole big brouhaha back then, as you can imagine. And guess who was on the other side? Yonos and Abishitz, okay? And he even says over there, he said, you know, this is, I bet you a lot of you know this. It's in the Crazy Placey. Let me see here. I'm looking here, pulling out my rusty, trusty, Crazy Placey. You must have heard of this. It's one of the most famous of the Crazy Placeys. I think most people have heard of this. Probably most people. You know, the Shulchan Aruch in the Hilchos Treifos, you know, in your day, obviously, it says, Nitalev bein biyabe bein machmas choli treifa. That there's a nitalev, there's no heart. So it's a treifa. It's one of the treifas. And in the Crazy Placey, which Yonos and Abishitz published in his lifetime, see, he talks about the Rambam and the others in Hilchos Shechita and Perek Yud, talking about all this sort of thing, what he leaves in, what he leaves out. I'm not going to go through the whole Arichas on here. But he says, this is Yonos Abishitz. Aton Novo Mashakos Vagon Tzvi Ashkenazi, meaning, he says, now let's get to what the Chacham Tzvi said. They're contemporaries. Yonos Abishitz was a Rav, he wasn't a Bezin at all. He was like a Darshan in Prague. And the Chacham Tzvi was in Hamburg, in Altona, Hamburg. The Nova Mashakosa, but she was a gone Tzvi Ashkenazi. Bereva Achas, here it is. Yeah, I told you, it was a girl. Posachas Tarnigolas. So she took the Shaila, you know, like people do to the chicken to the rabbi for kashrus questions, and opened up Tarnigolas. Vachosol Omedes Bechader Lecho. And there was a cat in the room. Keep on no fell if anything falls out. So notice the Chacham Tzvi is going to say the cat ate it. And anyway, they opened the thing, and there was no heart when they opened up the chicken. The Herich Ba'agana Nal, and Yonos Abishitz says the Chacham Tzvi went into his Arichas, and he says, Dvarav Tchilos and Mosok, B'sof and Marer. The beginning was good, but then by the time he concluded, it was wrong. It was bad. V'lo yachlu adas b'nei Yisrael l'shtosan. Ki marim heim. So it's pretty strong language against the Chacham Tzvi. This is why I'm making this point. Because when our hero, of Tali Katz, sides with the Chacham Tzvi, he's getting involved in a controversy. Ki nishan al divrei kesef mishnah. Because the Chacham Tzvi relied on Kesef Mishnah with Kashu Labilti Efsha Shia Balchai's Mam Below Lev. And he said, you know, scientifically, nothing can live without a heart. So he said, we can definitely assume that the girl didn't notice that the heart fell down. And the cat ate it. That part is okay, right? But the rest of it, and he goes on, the Mara, because the Mara also went Nitalib in a certain case. But then I feel niftar beidim ksheir veidu sheish kivul animsa pasi ki edim shakri heim benishal rajwa. But what do you call it? The Chacham Tzvi said that even if it wasn't a case where a girl brought the chicken, it was already like somewhat open, so you could be toilet if the heart fell out and he's eaten by the cat. But even if you brought a whole chicken, you cut it open, it wasn't a heart. Let's put it this way, that even if Adam said it had no heart, you wouldn't believe him, okay? And the understanding is against this, and so on and so forth. And I remember he said he consulted with the university. Where is it over here? He asked the medical school at the University of Halle, which is in Prussia, and they agree with Yonis Abshitz, you know, that it is possible or something like that. All I'm saying, and therefore it's true. So why am I making this? There's a whole book on this, right? I mean, you know, this is a big deal. Once upon a time, the rabbinic world is full of these interesting controversies. It's the type of thing, I mean, he wrote a book on it, so now everybody, every Tom, Dick, and Harry can get into all the details. It's one of the things you take on scholar in residence if they want to talk about a controversy from yesteryear. So I'm simply saying, as the Rabbi in Frankfurt, he's part of that, our hero, Naftali Katz, okay? And there he's, operating in the Frankfurt ghetto. Now, Frankfurt ghetto was a relatively confined space, which was overpacked with people. And he's there, I think, from 1704 to 1711. So, you know, those years, which is interesting to me because those are the years of the War of Spanish Succession, the famous campaigns of the Duke of Marlborough and the Prince Eugene of Savoy against the French. And very famous. And if you're Jewish, heck with that. You know, there's always wars going on somewhere. But business is business. Life goes on. And Frankfurt, you know, was not captured by the French. So it's like living near a war zone, but you're not in the war zone. It's just interesting how the Jews lived their lives. And because Frankfurt was actually the formal capital of the Holy Roman Empire, where they had the coronations and all that junk. So anyway, here's the thing. In 1711, all in the middle of all these wars and everything, a big fire broke out and destroyed the entire Jewish ghetto. You know, houses and houses, dozens of houses and so forth. And our hero was blamed. He's the Mrs. O'Leary that started the whole fire. And he got arrested. Okay? And therein lies the whole tale. So, you probably don't know what I'm talking about. But if you go online here, let me find this here. 1 second. Let me see here. 1 second. Yeah, here you go. Yeah, look at this. Son of a gun. There's a Wikipedia article, but it's in Hebrew. Hasrefa begetu Yehudi b'shal Frankfurt. Somebody did a whole article on this. Okay. Here, let me see if I can translate into English. Save you the trouble. I'll do part in the English, part in the Hebrew. Forget it. The English is backwards, you know, as happens sometimes when you do this. Hasreifa parts of Besvivas Yoshal Shemona Be'er Beis Yoshal Naftali Katz. There's a whole, it's a famous episode in German history. And you'll see, the Jewish ghetto burned down and not a geisha house was touched, even though it lived next door to the ammo dump. So if it would have touched that, the whole place would have blown up kablooey, which is exactly, as you know, what happened to the Pnei Yeshua. There was a fire or something, and what do you call it? And it hit the ammo dump and went kablooey, and it killed his whole family and smashed them to bits. I'm talking about the Bnei Yeshua. He writes about it in his Hagdama, you know. So, but that was somewhere else. That was in Lemberg, I think. Here, this is in Frankfurt. And what's going on over here? Hamchuna Beis Eichel. The name of this house was Beis Eichel. Baizeh, which was 10 meters or so. Benton Gdoba Yudengasa. Yudengasa, the Jewish street, that's what the ghetto consisted of. Hamakam Murkas, a ghetto, more basic and essence. It was obviously in a very prominent place opposite the synagogue. Haruach HaChazaka, Tzvivus, Berchova, Mivna, Tzar, Yudengasa. The fact that there was a big wind, because it was in January of 2011, so this is the winter in Germany, and a fire starts, and the wind, you know, blows the fire and spreads it from house to house, and it was overcrowding, the Tzvifus Berchova, I told you before. This all caused the rapid spread of the fire, it says, and the way Mivna bought the house is all built of wood, so it's like a perfect storm, you know what I mean? So, let's put it this way. The whole place was burned down, and all of a sudden, now only four people were killed, remarkably. Only four Jews died. But everybody was homeless. So just think about this. I mean, the entire ghetto, a couple thousand Jews, homeless. And it's January, in the winter. And, you know, and what happens then? Okay? So, Sefer Torahs were burned, you know, the synagogues were burned, the yeshiva was burned. You get it. Okay? Now, the non-Jews were worried that it might spread, and it didn't. Okay? It didn't. That's the interesting part. And the fire raged for a day or two. So it was like a big fire. And how did it happen? Who caused it? Okay? Nisrifu Arba Anoshim, Chepsi Arabim, and property, and 36 Sefer Torahs. And economically, people were wiped out. Think about that, you know? You have your money with you and all itself. It's literally burned to a crisp. It was like a gezeira or something like that, right? And Toshvei Yudengasa Horshel Liskar Dias Rabbat Notes from Frank Rashiel Kamadvayim. The city council passed an emergency measure that the Jews are able to live in Gaisha houses as guests if they pay. But whoever they couldn't pay, how you have no money? So it could happen. So the rest of the Jews had to go to the suburbs, little towns near Frankfurt, where they tried to hold out until they could, you know, recover. It was a terrible business. You know, next to Frankfurt is Hanau, Rödelheim, Offenbach, those places. And that's where they went. And it's a famous episode over here, okay? Now, Lachar Sreifa, Hamoitzer Reni, Kovo Takanobi. Afterwards, they passed a lot of fire code regulations, as we would say today, right? And, you know, which was the right way to do it, okay? So the Jewish ghetto was rebuilt, interestingly, even though they hated the Jews. Woo, did they hate the Jews in Frankfurt. But the Jews wanted to live there for whatever reasons, business and otherwise. And the place was rebuilt, with, as we say today, building according to fire code. Okay? Now, how did it start? Now, you know, I want to tell you something. I'll tell you something. You have no idea how bad it was to live in the Frankfurt ghetto. Even though I didn't talk about it, wait a second, hold on for a minute. Just 1 minute. Let me get this. Here, I have this book by Niall Ferguson. He's a very good historian. He wrote about the Rothschild family. And they started in Frankfurt, as you know. One minute. Here we go, listen to this. Protection, meaning the Jews were protected in Frankfurt under the laws, meant extraordinary tight regulation. Listen to what I'm about to read you. The details of which were set out by the city council in the Stettigkeit, which was a statute which was read out loud in the Schul every year. Under its terms, which remained in force until the end of the 1700s. So during the time we're speaking about now, I'm talking about the early 1700s, the Jewish population was restricted to 500 families. The number of weddings was rationed to 12 a year, and the age of marriage, you couldn't get married before you were 25. In other words, they want to stop prue or vu. Okay? And it was in Germanic regulation, though. The rules were enacted in law. You know what I'm saying? You can't get married. If you want to get married younger than 25, move, leave the city. Vakasha. No more than two Jews from outside were allowed to settle in the ghetto each year. It's all measures to keep the population down. It's like the people want to do Trump with the immigration restrictions. No more than 2 Jews each year. Jews were prohibited from farming or from dealing in weapons, spices, wine, and grain, because their goyim had that. Jews were forbidden to live outside the Judengasse, the Jewish street, and until 1726, meaning during the lifetime of our hero, were obliged to wear distinctive insignia, 2 concentric yellow rings for men. So that's the original Jewish badge. You know, it's not like Hitler with a mug and David. It was 2 concentric rings, yellow rings, on your clothes, and a striped veil for women at all times. They were confined to the ghetto every night. They were confined to the ghetto, meaning there was a wall around the ghetto, every Sunday and during Christian holidays. At other times, they were forbidden to walk in the town more than 2 abreast. So they didn't want to see a bunch of Jews. They were barred from entering municipal parks, entering municipal inns or coffee houses, and the promenades around the town's picturesque walls. It's like you'd say today, they can't go to the nice neighborhoods. They were not even allowed near the town's ancient cathedral, and they entered the town hall by the back door if they had business there. Jews were permitted to visit the town market, but only during set hours, and were forbidden to touch vegetables and fruit there. If a Jew appeared in court, he had to swear a special oath, and I've talked about it in the past, which reminded all present of the penalties and maledictions which God imposed on the cursed Jews. We did this a little while ago. If he heard a non-Jew say, "You the machmoris," no, this Jew, do your duty in the street, he was obliged, even if it was by a boy, to doff his hat and step to one side. So as he had to demonstrate your inferiority, it's like the Pact of Omer by Islam. And if a Jew had occasion to go outside the city, for which a special pass was required, he had to pay double the amount of toll paid by a non-Jew when he entered the town. In return for this protection, protection, every Jew paid a special Leibzoll or body tax. All this meant that the Frankfurt Jews spend most of their lives within the high walls and gates of the Judengasse. Today, virtually nothing remains of this prison/street. And it's a few blocks long. All but a couple of houses were demolished by the Frankfurt authorities during the time of Sansa Riviel Hirsch. And what little, it's physically demolished and, you know, urban renewal. And what little remained was wiped out by the American bombers during World War II. However, you go to Frankfurt today, you won't see it. The foundations of a part of the old street have recently been excavated. And these give us a rough idea of the inordinately cramped conditions of life in the ghetto. Curving from the Bornheimer Gate in the north towards the Jewish cemetery in the south. Listen to this. How big was the ghetto in Frankfurt? It was 1/4 mile long and no more than 12 feet wide and sometimes 10 feet wide. So the street, there are 2 rows of houses opposite each other, and the street is 10 feet wide, 12 feet wide. I mean, it's garnished. And that's where everything happens. Having originally been designated a ghetto at a time when the Jewish population was no more than 100, the lane was horribly overcrowded. Meaning, what was originally designed for 100 people, by 1711, which is the time of our hero, over 3,000 people lived there. So imagine housing appropriate for 100 people, and now for 3,000. Accommodating them all in such a small area required a high degree of architectural ingenuity. Houses were just 8 feet wide and had up to 4 stories. Do you hear this? And behind each row, an additional row was constructed. So in other words, 2 sets of houses and a street, and then another 2 sets of houses. Fire was an inevitable hazard. Indeed, all or part of the Judengasse was destroyed by major fires in 1711, 1721, and 1774. The biggest was the one I'm talking about in the time of our hero, you'll see. This meant that life was both dear and cheap, meaning expensive and cheap, the guy's an Englishman, because the demand for housing far outstripped the supply. So a 4-room house in the north end of the Judengasse cost as much as Goethe, he's the famous German writer who's not Jewish, paid for a 20-room mansion in Gross Hirschgraben. Hear what I'm saying? Like today in Lakewood or something, you know. In other words, the rents are crazy, okay? Because that's the only place you can be. So it cost as much to pay for a stupid 4-room apartment as for a 20-room mansion by the Goyim. And life was cheap, because of the lack of sanitation, the lack of light, the lack of fresh air, it all reduced life expectancy. So imagine if the COVID hit the Frankfurt ghetto, you see? In the 1780s, it was estimated that the average mortality among the Jews was 58% higher than among non-Jews. A traveler in 1795 observed, quote, how most of the people in the Frankfurt Jews, even those who are young, look like walking dead. Their deathly pale appearance sets them apart from all other inhabitants in a most depressing way. Later, after the walls had been partly demolished, Judengasse was romanticized to some degree, but it wasn't. And at the time, when Goethe, the famous German non-Jewish writer, he's like the most famous non-Jewish writer, visited it, he's from Frankfurt. He said, this is what Goethe says, the lack of space, the dirt, the throng of people, the disagreeable accents of the voice, altogether it made the most unpleasant impression, even upon the passerby who merely looked through the gate, meaning himself. So he didn't go in. It was a long time before I dared go in there alone, and I did not return there readily. When once I had escaped that multitude of people, all of them with something to sell or hawk, all of them indefatigably buying and selling, because that's where you had to do your business, okay? And Ludwig Born, who grew up there, looked back in memory. He said it was a long, dark prison into which the highly celebrated light of the 18th century had not been able to penetrate. Stretching ahead of us is an immeasurably long street, near us just enough room to reassure us that we can turn around as soon as the wish overcome us, meaning it was a narrow street. Over us is not sky, which the sun needs in order to expand in its breath. One does not see the sky usually. One sees only sunlight. An evil smell rises from everywhere around us. Look, the kids played there. The animals did whatever they did there. People are selling there. There are, kiosks and sell. It's crazy. And the cloth that is supposed to shield us from infection, meaning you walk in the ghetto with a mask, serves also to catch the tears of compassion or hide the smile of malice from the gaze of the watching Jews. Tramping laboriously through the filth slows our pace down enough to permit us the leisure for observation. We set our feet down skittishly, because I'll tell you again, the animals are all over the place, so just figure what it's like to walk there. Okay? I won't be more graphic. We set our feet down skittishly and carefully so we don't step on children. These swim around in the gutter. They creep around in the filth, innumerable as vermin hatched by the sun from the dung heap. Who would not indulge these little boys in their small desires? You know, give them a candy or something. If one were to consider playing childhood as the model for reality of life, then the cradle of these children must be the grave. And it goes on, you know, on and on and on. So the point is, Frankfurt ghetto was a bummer. In spite of what I just said, it wasn't a slum like you find with a crime-ridden and all that kind of stuff. And the Jews were in this because the anti-Semitic legislation caused this. And so the Jews had no choice but to put up with the best that they could, and the overcrowding and all the rest of it. And here came a fire and burned the whole place down. And when they rebuilt it, they did rebuild it a better fire code. But everything else was the same. It was still narrow and unhealthy and high and narrow. You know, it was terrible. It was a Malkum Torah. So people want to be the rabbi there. I wouldn't think so. But I'm wrong. People, you know, strove for it and so on and so forth. Now, here's the thing. What caused the fire? They launched an investigation. Everybody said, our hero did it. It's all the fault of Naftali Katz. Why? Oh, everybody knows that he's into black magic. This is what the people in Frankfurt said. And some of the Jews said it also. Okay? Some Jews said it also. See, he was arrested as a, if not arsonist, I guess you'd say criminal negligence. Your criminal negligence caused the fire. That's basically what happened, okay? Now, he could have gotten in big trouble. He could have gotten killed. Let me just see here. Hold on for a second. I want to tell you something. There is, God, I forgot to tell you this. I really have to thank Chaim, you the mayor, he got me this. There's a guy who's, I'll repeat what I said in the beginning. You never heard of Naftali Katz. And some guy, Rabbi Rafal Ben Shemuel, Sephardi, obviously, he got really involved in this, and he wrote a very, very frum bio and his tzava in great length. That I'll do next time because it's taking too long. But just want to tell you over here that, here we go. He got arrested. I'll read in English because it's easy to read in English for me than for Hebrew. It was not difficult to concoct stories that blamed the Jews. Among the accusations leveled because of the fire, and I want to repeat, the fire did not hit the Geisha quarters. Incidentally, before I continue, this is a famous problem in Jewish history. Fires break out and they blame the Jews. That is the reason, and it caused pogroms and persecutions, anti-Semitism, expulsions, all kinds of stuff throughout Jewish history. This is why we do not follow the Talmudic law if a fire breaks down a house on Shabbos. Look in the Shulchan Aruch, it's the Ramal, right? That, you know, and I know that the Gemara and Shabbos and the Mishnayos even, what's it called? Matzilin. You know, you can say if a fire breaks out, Chas V'Shalom on Shabbos, you can say what you need for the three Seudos, right? And maybe all this. And the Mishnah lays out what you're allowed to save, and everything else has to be consigned to the fire, right? You know that. It's in Masechta Shabbos. We don't do that. The Ramah says, if a fire breaks out, you put it out and call the fireman, whatever you need to do so, because otherwise the guy will blame it on the Jews, and the Jews are arsonists, and they'll kill everybody because it happened. So the Jewish history taught this. So here, it didn't exactly happen that way, but they're blaming the Jews. After all, it was the Jewish quarter, those blocks with those two sets of cramped houses that burned down to the ground. So among the accusations leveled against the Rav was that, first of all, this is what they said. He was cooking for a big feast and carelessly caused a fire. Of course, that's a total lie. Can you imagine the Shach, the Taznav, the cats doing the cooking? I mean, he's not a caterer, you understand? But it got out of hand. Here's another one. He threw a Christian cross into the fire to show that it was worthless. That's from Shub. There was a guy. This is how our hero entered into general history. Otherwise, he'd only be known to Jews. This fire is famous, and it's part of Frankfurt history, and there are paintings of it and all the rest of it, and artistic representations, and a medal was issued by the city and so forth. At that time, lived in Frankfurt Professor Schutt, S-C-H-U-D-T, who was a Christian Hebraist and pretty doggone anti-Semitic. So they used to have these German guys who were into Hebrew, and they were quote-unquote the experts on Judaism. A bunch of them. There was Eisenmenger, and there was Schutt and others. And they're very, very interesting to read because they're describing Jewish life as they observed it in their time, even though they're very anti-Semitic. Therefore, you can't trust a lot of what they say, and they always put a bad spin on everything. But you can find diamonds in the dung heap, as they say. Now, there's a lot of things they point out in terms of Minhagim and Hanhagas and Jewish practices that you can recover from, therefore you know how to. So Schutt, in his Yiddish Mekverdik, I think it was called, Jewish Remarkable Facts, he wrote a book. He was considered the Bucky, and he's from Frankfurt. He was there when the fire happened. He said the rabbi caused it. And the way he heard it, he said, was that he wanted to show that the cross is... This is not true. Notice the story's a lie. But this is what they said. That he took a crucifix and he threw it into fire, showed nothing would happen. And ha! God showed how wrong he was, and Jesus burned the whole ghetto down. That was one version of the story. Another one was he used to make candles in his home, and the candles were treif, and therefore he had long candles, and the result is a fire started and burned down the whole place. Some say that there were fats in the oven, and his wife caused the fire by not being careful, that the flames would catch hold with the schmaltz that was already in the oven and cause a big fire. Another one was, this is the most famous of them, that, and this is the one that entered German literature and maybe Jewish literature to a degree, and that is, he made a kamiya. This is the story. Again, it's not true. I'm just telling you the famous stories. He made a kamiya in which an amulet in which he did hashbo'os. In other words, you cause shadim and malachim and stuff like that to be subservient to your will. And there is a malach in charge of fires, and there's a malach in charge of putting out fires. And he wanted to show, either to himself or to students, there's a famous painting of him trying to show it to students. I repeat, this is a legend. It didn't happen. I'm just telling you what the imagination is. and is widely believed. And so watch this. So there's the good angel and the bad angel. The good angel causes the fire and the bad angel puts out, and I said it backwards. The bad angel causes the, for our purposes, let's call it good and bad. For purpose of my description. So the bad angel has caused the fire and the good angel will put out the fire. And he made a kamiya, which will invoke the good angel to put out the fire. And therefore he started the fire with the idea of making a laboratory demonstration that his kamiya can put out a fire. So it'll be a big fire, and then the kamiya will kick in, and the good angel will put out the fire. And it didn't happen. Now, some will say like this, you know, it didn't happen because it didn't happen. And others will say like this, that he wanted to, what was the lesson over there? Hold on for a second. I'm looking in Horowitz's Frankfurt Rabbinin. Eidecha Mesaper, Alashmush, and Afotzke, Rav Atzmo hits his age. He lit the fire. Kedil Haris Leila, Son of Shmata, to show his followers, Ketzir Yedil Chabas is up. He can put it out through the right Kamiya. But Vadi Hoy Matzliach Bakach, and it would have worked. A minute here. Would have worked. Lule his balbel, Vishbias Malcha Ish Mokam Malcha Mayim. But he had a bilbul, meaning he got confused, and he invoked, Kabbalistically, he invoked the bad angel instead of good angel. So notice he lit the fire, and then he said, now, what do I know? I'm just making this up. Let's see. Sis boom ba, now come the good malach and put it out. But instead, and let's see, the good malach is called b. And instead, he got confused, and he says, sis boom ba, come and put it out. I'm calling upon Bo. No, you're supposed to do Bo, not Bo. And you call it the wrong one, and that made the fire bigger and burned down the whole ghetto. You see what I'm saying? So in other words, depending how you spin it, because these are all rumors, none of them are true. Depending how you spin it, you make a look, it was a big Kabbalist or a bad Kabbalist, or makes you a Maimonidean, meaning like this. You think you can manipulate the system? If Hashem doesn't want it to work, it won't work. Here we get into the whole question. He was known as a Kabbalist. To the Goyim, that means you're black magic. You understand? No, the Kabbalist in the sense of Kabbalah Ma'asit, that you can actually do things, not just know the shitas and the ideas, which are endless, that you find in Kabbalah. The kind of things you see in the Kisvei Ari and the Ramchal and all the others. They're not dealing with actual going about and performing supernatural things. But he was into that as well. And there are all kinds of form and books and traditions about how that works also. So those, how do you turn somebody into a monkey, you know, that kind of thing. And I'll be like, well, you can do it. You know, if you know the right shemos and so on and so forth. And hashboz malachim, you know, if you know how to control the angels. And let's put it this way. We're talking about the concept of magic. Now, magic is kind of weird. Now, does the Jewish religion believe in magic? Can people do... is there such a thing as Kabbalah Mises? Yeah. I don't know if the Maral made a golem, but somebody did. How you do that? It could be done. Right? In other words, does science and logic comprehend the totality of reality? So the assertion here is it does not. There is empirical science. Yes, there's no question about that. There is. And no question about it. And there's also the other realm. And it's a different reality. Problem goes like this. So let's say I know how to do it. Let's say I can do Kabbalah Ma'asit or something like this. Or magic in any way. Like Kochas HaTumah. Like you see, you know, they talk about it all the time. Can you control God? You know what I'm saying? In other words, you want this and this to happen. Can you make it happen? Now, the way around that is to say, like this, God lets you make it happen. Another way of saying it is, if God doesn't want it to happen, it won't happen. So according to the story I just told you, which is a legend, you know, it's really a great story. He was Nisbalbel. So notice, he wanted to cause the fire to go out and call the good angel. He wanted to call Be. But instead, he got confused and called Bo. You see, Hashem, you understand what I'm saying? Hashem can make it happen. that your spell will be cast different than what you wanted. It's a little bit like the Bilam story, Lahavdol, you know? But it's this idea. Do you want to do this and this? But God's in charge and he did that and that. So it's kind of cool. It's like I always say, how's it go? A guy heard from the Bilam story that, how's it go? Guy heard from the Bilam story that there's a moment every day where whatever you ask for will be granted. Okay? And Bilam knew that moment or something like that. So the guy said, okay, great. He sits all day long, says, I want $1 million, I want $1 million, I want $1 million, I want $1 million, $1 million, because sooner or later it will come the right moment. I want $1 million, I want $1 billion, I want $1 billion, I want $1 billion. Choo! I want $1 billion. Get it? God make you sneeze. So what? And that was the second. So it's all based on this idea that you can, you know, be mechav in the right moment. All I know is he got into big trouble and was arrested. However, they did have a trial and he was found innocent, meaning he didn't do it. Instead, some idiot who lived in his house was a tailor. Listen to this. And therefore must have had material, flammable materials all over the place and was working on some kind of article of clothing. Was working as a tailor at night. Therefore, there was no electricity. Therefore, he had a candle. All of a sudden, that's not a great idea. If I'm in a shop full of fabrics, it ain't the smartest thing to learn by candlelight. And if it is, I better be doggone careful how it was. And the guy left the room to go get something or go to the bathroom, whatever he did, and he left the candle burning. So naturally, a spark shot out from this, that, and the other, hit one little piece of fabric, and the rest is history. It's like, you know, so the rabbi was found innocent, but the Jewish community nevertheless was wiped out. And it's interesting, by the way, here, he has it over here at Horowitz. Listen to this, that the Jews had to leave and move to other neighborhoods, except for a few people that were nice Christians allowed them to live with them. And Gamraf Toliatzmo Zochal Achnos Zarchim Noem Beves Ezrachim Hugan, that there was a Choshva Christian burger, a balabos, and he said, you can stay in my house. Hachayat Ha'uman Yohannes Finger. And this guy, whose name was Finger, who was not Jewish, he was a nice guy, and what do you call it? He how should I put it? And he said, you can stay with me. And he did. So in other words, I assume he lived in a nice house. And the famous story, let me see, do they have it here? The famous story is that he gave him a bracha. The rabbi gave him a bracha. Here we go. At his trial. Here. Let me read you some of this thing here. This is cute. Others asserted absurdly that the rabbi had befriended a particular Christian officer living near Frankfurt. And together they came with the idea of digging up a certain location in the forest, going to find a bunch of diamonds and pearls under it. And Naftali was expected to find a location using Kabbalistic magic. But when he performed the ritualist procedure, he made a mistake and instead it brought a fire to burn down the whole neighborhood. You see how these, you know, ideas go to shut that Mamzer, that historian, he includes all these things. And he says, I don't know if it's true, but it could be true. You know, he really, you know, was a bad guy. Other Jewish sources say that after the fire began, Naftali summoned the good angel, but he got this babble in the words. That's another version of it, okay? And the Marshishach, who took over after him, that's the ancestor of the Chassam Sofer, says in the beginning of his book that the fire lasted, this is cool, the fire lasted 24 hours. In other words, it started at, let's say, 7:45 in the night, and it went out. It finally ended at 7:45 the next night. Literally the same hours. Even the Christians, by the way, said that it is like assertions for it because, what do you call it? It happened in the year 1711. That's the Christian year 1711. And if you do Latin, I kid you not, Platea Iudorum Conflagrat, you know, from conflagration, it comes out, the Gematria, the Latin, I'm serious about this, the Latin Gematria comes out to the year 1711. So they saw it's like, you know, say, we're not the only ones that do Gematria. Let me put it this way. A sad thing, by the way, is what was burned this fire to Maram Schiff. You know, we only have a little bit of the Maram Schiff. He was in Frankfurt, you know. So all of his ksavim, which would have ended up being published, were destroyed in the fire, except the little that survives in the back of the shas. It's a small portion of all this sort of thing. And The Goyim did say, to their surprise, nobody blamed the rabbi. So that was interesting. He defended himself by saying that his maidservant sent something burning. He ran out of the house, even though he was certain there was no fire because it was a fast day. They had some kind of private fast day over there, you know, the Ekis. And his wife wasn't cooking, but he saw a closed room, and he opened the room, and the fire leaked out and burned part of his beard. And you could show at the trial that part of his beard had been burned. And it was that dumb tailor, as I told you before. Okay? That dumb tailor. And look at this. The guy put out a medal, a medal, which has, and you can see a picture of it, you go online, and by some guy named Vermes who didn't like Jews. And on one side, it shows a father and a mother and two children, hands outstretched in lament. And behind them, you see the flames of the fire destroying the building. While it says it's a good thing that in such a manner is proved. In other words, this proves the Christianity is right. And on the other side is a Lushan in Latin. Oh, miraculous day, no less than wretched event. Alas for the fortunate day when in Frankfurt, the Judengasse of the Jews was destroyed by fire, Rabbi Naftali from Poland being the cause, and over a 24-hour period, the whole thing burned to the ground, and the ammo dump was not touched, and all the houses of the Christians were unharmed, and so on and so forth. In other words, let's put it this way. You tell me the whole Jewish neighborhood burned down? What a bummer. What's for lunch? You understand? So this puts him in a different category, and basically he had to leave town. The community, your bad luck, and the authority said, just go. And that ends an important part in his career. Now, I've gone for very longer than I showed up, so let's call this part one, and next time we'll do part two. So again, I want to thank our sponsor in Lakewood, who will remain anonymous at his own request. And I told him this is an unusual story, but I will honor it and try to finish it up next week.